Welcome to the Mining Pulse, checking the heartbeat of Africa's mining. Every week we gather the specialists, run the diagnostics, and give you the market intelligence you need. What's running hot? What's flatlining? What are the vital signs telling us?
Travis, JD, welcome to the Mining Pulse. Today we're very honored, Graham and I, to have the two of you in the session with us. Mainly because I would say for me personally, you've been the sole inspiration behind us taking the plunge and starting this podcast, The Mining Pulse. The great work that you and JD and the other people at the Money of Mine have been doing in Australia has well and truly, you know, been a motivation for Graham and I to set this up. And so to have the two of you talking to us today is an honor. Thank you, JD. Thank you, Trav.
Mate, it's an absolute honor to be on Africa's preeminent mining podcast. Thank you for the invitation.
We're very flattered, James, and it's the least we could do after you showed us around Africa, your home country in South Africa and Rustenburg over a year ago now. So looking forward to chatting.
Those were a fun couple of days in South Africa.
Yes, I still can't believe that this random stranger we'd never met was willing to pick us up from the airport and just take us around to South Africa for like 3-4 days.
Unbelievable few days, wasn't it?
Wonderful.
Didn't your mum and dad tell you not to go with strangers anywhere? And then you picked James of all people?
I was quite concerned when his like tactics to try and charm us was taking us to Wimpy's and ordering rainbow milkshakes, because I felt like that came straight from a playbook my mum warned me about.
Gotta be careful. Anyway, it turned out fine, and here you are now. So one of the questions I think we was, how did it all start? Did you guys start from scratch, or did you have some help, or how did you come to be on the Money of Mine?
How did it start for you? I don't know. I think how do most new endeavors begin with an idea that is not much more than an idea to begin with, and you're kind of quickly trying to validate whether or not it has any merit or not. And for us, we skipped the part of trying to validate it, and we all quit our jobs, JD, myself, and our business partner at the time, Maddie, and went kind of headfirst into a new business endeavor. We had come from different backgrounds, investment banking for myself and JD, and Maddie was an underground miner. And we thought, well, if we put our collective efforts together, maybe we can make some interesting content. And we thought if it didn't work, then we'll just move on and do something else. But we'll learn pretty quickly whether or not, hopefully, whether or not it will work or not. And that was 3 years ago.
That's bloody brave, mate. That's bloody brave. So all three of you quit your jobs.
Yeah.
My wife in a pretty fortunate position, not having, you know, that stage in life, you know, when you can take a bit of risk, and we're all pretty keen to give it a go. And, you know, thankfully things haven't worked out too bad.
And it's been a phenomenal ride. I mean, if you look at, you know, from, was it April 2023 till now? I mean, you have over 15,000 subscribers now, and you're at the point where people are actually phoning you and asking to be on your show. I mean, how's that journey been? And how's that interaction now with these big CEOs and these guys who are listing? I mean, like, how's that journey actually been?
Interesting. The way you frame the question is speaking with the big CEOs. The CEOs never really, like, intimidated us, I would say. Mostly because especially when we kicked off, we probably came from, like, a perspective of thinking most CEOs are in the bucket of being quite promotional. And we thought if we wanted our observation of mining content at that point in time, because our lens was from, you know, the investment community, we thought it was too promotional. We thought a CEO who has a stock to promote is part of their job. They're probably going to be like less transparent and honest and aligned in general with just your typical like investors out there. And we thought, well, if we're going to try and do some kind of content, we want it to be original, but more importantly, like as aligned as possible with the audience. So we made a pretty active like decision quite early on to do as minimal content involving CEOs as possible. And that led us towards a lot more content was our own original analysis. And then conversations with like the investment community, like fund managers and the likes was where we found like our I suppose, the stuff that we really liked, the conversations that we loved having. Over time, we've been more open to having quite like, you know, proven like CEOs with track records, operational delivery, like impressive credentials, discoveries, etc. on our show. But yeah, how's it? I'm not sure if that answers your question, but Yeah, JD, you got
the journey itself, like in a nutshell, has been phenomenal. It's been a heap of fun, and that approach, kind of like what Trav was talking about there, has evolved and changed quite a bit over the last 3 years, and it's just been a journey of learning one day to the next and trying to wrap a business around it that makes sense, that is aligned with the audience, because it's probably worth highlighting that at the crux of our idea was that can we do this without taking money from mining companies, because that is what we thought was kind of the status quo in the media landscape prior. And mm-hmm. we were just eager to test whether we could stay independent and keep doing it. And thankfully to date we've been able to do that and stay true to that, which we're, you know, super dedicated to, and continue to see what other businesses we can wrap around this and tie within it. So yeah, I think in a nutshell that's a kind of summary of our philosophy on starting the business, and captures a bit of what we've learned to date.
And Jez, I suppose your target audience was more investors, or what was the primary target audience?
Yeah, I think you could say investors. But speaking to the background that we had, we in our sort of, both Trav and I met in our first kind of role in finance here in Perth, and we wanted to be kind of like fly on the wall type discussions with people that had interesting perspectives, people that had experience, they knew the sector inside and out, and we wanted to kind of share that fly on the wall type discussion about the companies, which we know thousands, tens of thousands of people across Australia and globally are thinking about and wanting to hear. We know that because we love listening to podcasts, we love listening to that type of content as well, and we had a suspicion that that might be the case. So we wanted to kind of create that, and that would be, you know, with investors as a kind of cornerstone. But there's a whole bunch of other conversations that we love having and have had previously. They can be just people within any kind of part of the industry, geologists, metallurgists, engineers that have an interesting kind of historical story, an interesting way of viewing the sector, or ways in which you can teach people and learn and all these sorts of things. Just I think as a North Star was just having conversations that we were very eager to have, and thinking that might be a good basis for what people would be keen to tune into.
It's been amazingly satisfying and interesting to us as more of the technical side of the business. So we kind of inside the mining industry, not so much financially minded. And so for us engineers and the people that our peers, the people we work with and that we chat to on a daily basis, they all listen to Money of Mine. And they're not investors. They may, you know, throw a couple of $1,000 or whatever at the stock exchange every now and then, but they certainly don't make a living out of it. But for us simple folks, I suppose, in the mining industry, your show has brought something which we've never had. And it's actually talking to that financial part of the business and the management oversight and the how all the shareholding works and the deal making that goes on. Those are things that have been removed from the technical people in the industry up until you came about. And so real fun listening to you, and I look forward to every episode.
I think your framing of simple folk is being very, very humble, because the simple folk in your words are the ones that actually make the mining industry happen and make it go forward. And I think it's a full credit to the people that have been super generous with their time and come on and shared their expertise on the show, because we know there's people with just a wealth of experience that we're so eager to speak with, that we have done to date, and continue to have that itch we want to scratch, because they're, you know, like I kind of said before, a lot of that has been kind of bottled up and not shared previously, and we're eager to do so.
You've got some super fun guys on there. I mean, Rusty and what's the coal guy? Is he in the States? Where is he?
Matt Water. Yeah. In West Virginia.
Amazing. Oh, there's some absolute legends on there that we look forward to having back.
I mean, you spent a long time working in coal, didn't you, James?
I did. And I mean, coal's still a pet mineral of mine, I suppose you can say.
Yeah,
I love coal. So I love listening to his chats.
Oh, yeah.
I suppose if you look back now, I mean, we're let's call it the real infancy stage where we are, but just the learnings from these guys who spent their time chatting with us, for me, that's been quite phenomenal. And I'm sure you guys have had the same journey with all these guys coming to chat with you guys as well.
I think it's a remarkable privilege to be able to have an avenue or a platform that some of the most respectable people are interested in participating in, because it gives you a wonderful window to build a relationship with those people, to learn from those people. I'm sure you guys have already had a ton of fun and will continue to have an enormous amount of fun just by having that kind of avenue for the people that you really respect to come on and share their perspectives.
Yeah, I think exactly to that point, the conversation you get to have before you press record and afterwards and perhaps in the lead up as well is just fantastic. It's a real perk of what we do.
It is. And those conversations, funny enough, are the ones that the viewers don't always get to see, especially not from us. I mean, I know that you guys have some pretty cool shorts that you put out of behind the scenes, and it's something we're busy playing with and learning for our viewers going forward. But you talk around those conversations, it's normally when you're having all those technical issues, when those fun conversations in the background are actually happening.
Technical issues is, No, you never want to have technical issues.
Hopefully more of the fun conversations and less of the technical issues, but you're 100% on the money.
500 odd episodes in and we still have technical issues.
We feel the pain.
You boys are both from Perth. Is it true that everyone in Perth is pretty much connected to the mining industry in some form or shape? Because
or 2 degrees of separation for sure.
How do two guys from the financial market then, do you have family or background? Like, I know JD, you've got your dad who's in the mining industry, but what other connections do you have to the industry, and why does this industry interest you so much?
Yeah, you're right. So do have that family connection, and kind of part of dinner table discussions all the time is that geological aspect. But I think just growing up in Perth as well, seeing on the big buildings in the city here, names like Rio Tinto, BHP and so on, you don't realise how much of an anomaly that is until you go to other places around the world. And, you know, it only kind of hits home when you have people come here in the mining industry and they think it's kind of almost out of place because they've never seen it before. So it is in and around you when you're growing up in a place like this.
So, I mean, I would like to chat a little bit about the purpose for our show and the purpose for versus the purpose that you guys set out to achieve. And I think for us, it's probably a bit different. We're not really appealing or, you know, looking at the financial side or the investor return side of the mining industry particularly. Our intent for starting this thing was really lifting the hood, if you like, of the mining industry and trying to show more people all the different aspects about mining and specifically in Africa. So it's more of a knowledge platform for us. We want to bring the African mining industry more together. We feel there's a lot of silos and people that operate in their own specialized field and then are often amazingly skilled engineers, geologists, you know, mining engineers. But they, when you ask them about their plans for the future and they say, well, I've got 4 or 5 years left to retire and I don't actually know who's going to take over from me. And so then we go to the universities and chat to them and they say, well, the classes that teach mining are, you know, empty. And they have to scale down on the amount of lecturers and teachers because there's just fewer and fewer students that are interested in this industry. And so we saw that and then saw what is, you know, to me, the obvious need for more and more mining as we go forward as humankind. And but the two just didn't match to me. And I thought, oh, there's a gap here. And we need to try and motivate for more people to consider this industry as a viable one.
In a lot of ways, your purpose and motivation was a lot more altruistic than ours, I think. And it's probably more noble and, you know, more broad and hopefully you reach more people as a result.
Yeah, I hope so.
I've got two things as well, James, that come to mind when you when you say that. Like, we have, you know, from time to time had messages come through from people studying here. Now, they might be studying something like finance, but would have never have kind of considered working within the mining vertical of the industry. And, you know, to a small extent, they've become at least interested and aware of it from listening, which is absolutely awesome. And the second point is that I think there's also a bit of a contrarian kind of streak that Trav and I like to talk up at least. And understanding that mining isn't the biggest industry in the world, it is, you know, a bit on the sidelines. It's not loved. Like, speaks to us a little bit in thinking from an investment perspective, again, that there's something to this, you know. Not everyone's paying attention to it. Everyone's looking at tech and all these other things. What's going on the side there? And I think that kind of makes it a kind of cool place to be.
But that's really the big thing is mining is actually cool. And there are really cool things happening in mining with really clever people. It's just, you know, as James said, is that it's not always shown that way. And you've just said it. You know, there's always this conception, you know, that miners are just out there to take stuff out the ground and, you know, they're going to walk away one day with a big hole there. But, you know, the discussions we've already had, I mean, the people have got a real love for what we do and how mining does it and doing it properly. You know, so I think those stories are hopefully what we're going to come across and give to people going forward. And hopefully that inspires people to come and see and that there is a multifaceted industry for people to get their teeth into. It doesn't matter really where you are, but you're still within mining.
100%. I read a book a little while ago about the early days of SpaceX and Elon Musk and what he was doing, and all the engineers on site trying to build Rocket 1 that failed and then Rocket 2 that failed and so on. And the story would just had so many parallels with like an exploration team out there trying to find a deposit, you know, trying to find something. I thought they, you know, the people were cut from the same cloth. So I totally agree with what you're saying there, Graham.
And I'm thinking you guys are probably a little bit different to us as well. Is you sitting in Perth, Australia's got the ASX, which is a big, well-known, one of the biggest probably investment platforms for the mining industry. So where you guys sit and have, you know, lattes and, you know, macchiatos and things with the bosses and the guys that are calling the shots in the mining industry and investing in the mining industry, our audience is more the people on the ground, like more the engineers, the operators, the government officials, the community people, contractors. And so I'm hoping that at the Mining Pulse, we'd be able to speak to another part of the mining industry. You know, you guys speak a lot to the C-suite level, I suppose. And the investor level.
100%. You're talking to the actual real part of the industry. So you can have fantastic conversations with people on the ground, people that make things happen, engineering capability, geology, metallurgy, all these cool things. There's such a rich like avenue of conversations to be had there.
And then you've got the big benefit of age, the two of you. You're so young. You know, so you probably know all of the techie stuff that Graham and I have to, you know, try and pick up now.
So for us, starting a podcast wasn't a midlife crisis, but for you it is? Is that what you're saying?
Totally. Past mid, who knows? Absolutely. But, I mean, there's so much available now from a tech point of view. So in terms of stats and data that you get from your podcast, I don't know if you're willing to share a little bit about what kind of intel you can get from people that do dial in, people that listen to you on YouTube or Spotify or wherever they dial into. Are there certain platforms that are preferred? And then secondly, who, like what kind of data are you able to gather in terms of who is listening?
So there's a few parts to that. One is the platform. The platforms are just, you know, the things that you would always expect. Spotify, YouTube, Apple, that consists like 95% plus higher of total like listenership, viewership. Those platforms definitionally won't give you granular information of the exact names of people who are tuning in. It does give you very detailed demographic breakdowns.
Okay.
In general, our audience is 55, between 50 and 55 is like a median age of our listeners, which is, you know, unsurprising. They're overwhelmingly male, which is also unsurprising.
That's worrying.
Yeah. And they're largely Australian, like 70% Australian, but 30% international as well. So there is there's definitely like an overseas element to the listenership. I would say from a granular perspective, who is it? We've done a fair bit of work to like figure out who our listeners are. And by the way, having a well-read newsletter helps us really hone in who that audience is on a per-person level as well. And they're a combination of executives and investors. It's like the intersection of mining companies, investors and advisors in that intermediate between the two are a huge part of our audience.
A ring of engineers and geologists and...
yeah. If you guys haven't started a newsletter, I reckon there's some merit in doing that to have a consistent way to reach the specific people.
And just that newsletter is so useful. I'm sure it's useful for you in terms of the whatever data you can get, but it's super useful for me as a subscriber. I love every morning having my quick feed. I don't know if I told you, but I invest in the ASX mining stocks for one reason only, not to make money. I lose a lot of money on that every year. I'm still invested in mining extensively because I had a theory that in order to, you know, be sort of bought into the newsfeed, I had to own something. And so if I was interested in whatever one of our customers' projects or something, if I was interested, say, for instance, in Fortuna Metals or something and what they're doing now in Malawi, I would go on the ASX, and because I was in Australia, I still have an account that's active, and so it was easy. But I'd buy like 500 stocks or something in Fortuna. And if I'm interested in Chilwa or one of these other guys, I wouldn't know anything about them, and you know, but I'm interested to know their newsfeed. And so instead of just keeping them on a watch list, which would have been way smarter, I went and, you know, bought these stocks.
There's definitely something to that. I think skin in the game gives you a lot more reason to follow along. Even if it's small, you just take more notice when you've got something at stake.
But now your newsletter, I think, is weaning me off of having to have all of them. Regularly,
the addictive traits
going to save me money.
I should flip the question on you guys. Is there a business case behind the Mining Pulse? Do you hope that there is becomes a business case, or do you think it's got this purpose of look what you've described, but you don't want it to be its own business?
It's a good question, Trav, and I suppose I don't know. We hope there's a business case somewhere down the line. I mean, at some stage, we'd like to have people like Sandvik Ground Support.
Derek will love that one.
Sandvik.
Sandvik, you know, helping us do what we do, because I don't think it would be sustainable if we carried on just Graham and I. We hope there's some support somewhere down the line. In terms of turning it into a profitable venture, for me, there's no real purpose to do that right now. But it would be nice if it's not such a negative cash drain, that's for sure. Because these do take a bit of money, you know, to come in, to set up. We're using a studio that we don't own at the moment. There are costs involved. And so it would be nice if eventually those costs could be recouped somehow. And we're working on that.
Yeah.
Any tips would be good.
The podcast studio business is not a bad business to be in. It's booming.
Yeah. That's it. I think, you know, as well, to you, I think in the end, as we grow, and hopefully when we get to the level number of subscribers you guys have, is that people have then seen the value of what the Mining Pulse is bringing to an African market and exposing across Africa as a whole. And then hopefully they see the value of actually coming and investing in us and the show. Being able to put more of that content, as James says, out, you know, to the industry. As James said, it hurts coming in and recording at times. Yeah, I think as we grow and as more people subscribe, I think it'll get easier over time.
But again, what guys like you, the two of you, are good at is the money side of business. Us engineers, we don't think about money, really. Someone pays us, it's good. They don't. So we'll take some cues from you, for sure.
I wouldn't speak as if we've got it all worked out either, you know. I think there's a lot that can go both ways, and a lot we can learn from you, you know. We're still working out a lot of things ourselves as well.
Oh, I wanted to ask you guys, JD and Travis, the stuff that really connects us is Africa and obviously the ASX. And I wanted to find out from you guys, now bringing it probably closer to home and all your conversations, what are you seeing with the investors and the stories they're saying and their listings with their projects into Africa? You know, what is making Africa appealing for them to come and actually do business here in Africa?
There's a lot to that question. And we're fresh off a trip to Africa. We came back pretty bullish on the countries that we visited as investment jurisdictions. But what is making it attractive right now might be less to do with Africa and more to do with the increasing unattractiveness of typical developed countries. Sovereign risk is everywhere. It appears in many different ways. In Africa, it often exhibits in a way that people think about, but in reliable jurisdictions, there's still a lot of sovereign risk. It can just pop up in different forms. And I think governments are not as reliable as they once were for stable mining regimes, for permitting, for timelines, for costs. There's just different risks, different strokes. And I think the investment community has an increasing awareness of the ways in which what used to be just like premier mining investment jurisdictions like Australia, like Canada, etc. They're just not what they once were. So you look elsewhere, the capital's got to go somewhere else. I don't think the risks have disappeared in Africa, but they've ebb and flow, right? Depending on whatever government, however stable things might have been. You guys know that nuance way, way, way better than we ever will. I just think the world needs these metals, and you have to dig them out of the ground somewhere, and you run out of the low-hanging fruit in the good jurisdictions. you've got to look elsewhere.
You cover a lot of ASX guys that are in Africa, right? There's a lot of the gold guys that you guys like and talk about in West Africa.
100%. I mean, a big portion of the ASX, particularly at the junior end, hunting for projects in Africa, or they have projects in Africa that they're developing. The producers are well represented as well. Like Africa as a continent for primary projects of ASX resource companies is the second, obviously, behind Australia itself. And that is far and away ahead of the third place continent being South America. Now, these things ebb and flow and change over time. And I think Trav was super succinct in how he said that. It's never level. It changes on geopolitical factors, on commodity prices, on everything. There are dozens and dozens of factors that play into this. And it's kind of dynamic and changing all the time.
I'm actually surprised that it's still that way, that Australia is still the biggest.
Yeah, I don't think that will ever probably change. There's a huge time zone factor to...
Is it way bigger?
Yeah.
Yes, it is way bigger, yeah.
Way, way bigger.
There's something like 100 listed companies I saw on ASX that are in mining in Africa.
What was your number, sorry?
170, I saw.
Yeah, that sounds about right. I did a rough scan earlier and got 200-ish or just below, so that sounds pretty on par from a number that's just below 1,000, you know, between 800 and 1,000.
806 mining companies on ASX. 26 of those are mining adjacent, so net them off.
And then so the bulk of them are Australian, and then you've got, you know, 170 to 200.
Now, yeah, 100%.
Australia as well.
And you've got primary project and secondary project as well to bear in mind, because so many of these companies will have projects over multiple jurisdictions.
I think if you look at like the main mining investment markets anywhere, there's an enormous time zone element to these things. So people are on the ASX, they're largely investing in jurisdictions where operations are somewhat happening during the same market hours. There's sufficient amount of overlap as the market itself. So that's why it's Australia dominant, absolutely. A little bit of Africa, not much South America. Go to Canada, it's America's heavy. Not as much, definitely like almost nothing in Australia and a little bit in Africa. And then London, it's pretty much all Africa. It's just time zones.
So I wanted to ask another question, and I'll touch back onto what James was saying earlier. If you take, for example, Fortuna, who are on the ASX listed, and they've just had a major investment out of the US. Do you think at some point, with all that Western investment coming, that there may become a push to be dual listed? Or do you reckon that these mid-tier junior guys will just ultimately stay within a specific jurisdiction? Or do you think the money's going to chase, for example, Australia, Joburg, or JC, or a Australia, New York? Do you think that is something that's going to start to play factors when it comes to money moving later?
The money will always flow to where the capital is. Historically in resources, the dominant exchanges are between Canada and Australia, and they go back and forth. Valuations on each change over time as well. Absolutely agreed. And like there's a bit of nuance to it as well. Thinking about one of the companies that Trav and I saw, Westwits, in just on the outskirts of Joburg, like they have a mine there. They have essentially a head office close to the mine, which is good, kind of how it should be. But they have an ASX listing now, incorporated, I think, in Australia. But you could make the case that it's almost a South African company just as much as it is an Australian company there.
That opens up another thought track that I'm not sure I want to go down. Yeah, maybe we'll leave it. I have a moral uncertainty around mining companies with their feet on the ground in one jurisdiction, but they're declaring their profits somewhere else.
I think in Westwits' case, they definitely would have their South African black empowerment-owned in-country entity, and the people that we met were, by and large, Africans.
And I would also add to that, James, I think it's like a great point. I think the mining industry, especially in this day and age in 2026, is, you know, has a much harder time doing that sort of behaviour than any other kind of sector. Netflix is a great example in Australia. They net like $1.5 billion in revenue, and they mark like $10 million in profit. It all just goes out. But if you have the actual asset in that country, at the end of the day, you're going to have a much harder time trying to do that sort of funny business.
Yeah. You know, mines contribute to so much in country. There's so much, you know, employment. There's obviously taxes that are paid. payroll taxes, many, many, many different things. They get diesel or whatever from power from the local suppliers, and there's the ports they use, the rails. There's many, many, many ways that mines in a country in Africa contribute to that country's growth, I suppose. Often not so much in terms of actual tax on profit because of the way the structures work. And I suppose they have to work like that because of where the money comes.
And that's probably why you see royalties as being even though royalties don't have the same alignment that equity or profit share does, but they've definitely become the dominant mechanism of government take because how do you dodge what you're supposed to pay on that? So you can understand how that's come about.
Yeah, and there's been a few stories in West Africa in particular around royalties and payments and of late.
I think Barrick might know a thing or two.
That's an interesting one. How are you seeing the market also changing with policy changing and this massive drive for localization and increase in local shareholding in these operations? You know, again, from an African perspective, do you see any of that happening and fears or thoughts or changes in discussions that you're having?
I think a lot of that stuff doesn't always trickle its way up to us until it's like in the investment community, until something goes catastrophically wrong. The investment community thinks you have a social license to operate until you don't, and all of a sudden, it's a catastrophe. So I think it's things that like we often just take for granted, assume that a company is like doing all of the right things. Yeah, the way to assess it is like who can operate for a really long period of time in a country. I mean, this is an extractive industry. You absolutely have to ensure that the fruits of this extraction are distributed in a way that is sensible for the communities that are hosting you for the time you're there. The companies that do that really well have an enduring long-term social license. Yeah, and they get that. There's great culture around all of that. I think you guys would know a lot more about that than us because we don't interface with the mines nearly as much as you guys do unless we do a dedicated trip to see a bunch, which thankfully we've done a few this year, but yeah.
I think to add to that, like in very simple terms, if commodity prices keep going up and up and the countries feel that the profit share arrangement is out of whack, that'll change. And we've seen that change over the past few years. And on a different note as well, we've seen phenomenally open borders in a globalized world over the last 50 plus years. I don't think you need to have too much macroeconomic foresight to say that that's kind of changing. And we're very much on a trajectory to do more with countries we have friendly alignments with and all these sorts of stuff. And that adds costs all along the route.
A really good friend of ours on the show, James Campbell, was talking around the juniors in particular. So the tier ones are great. I mean, they've got really a good bank balance. But those real small junior guys getting in, I mean, he was saying like 9 out of 10 are failing due to funding. Is it, again, are these real junior guys, are they not in the right place to be able to get the funding? How do we improve those figures? He spoke about on our episode around the incubator out of London for them. How do we get more of these juniors to become successful and start operating in Africa?
I think it's an awesome question, and there's people far smarter than myself that have done some great thinking about this, whether we take a venture capital type approach to this. The incubator type approach is a really cool one. I don't think it's massively, separated from just how hard exploration is, and you just want to continually try to improve your odds. The chance of finding a project that becomes an actual mine is one in well over 1,000, so it's a long shot kind of game.
That's what I'd say. It's like if only 1 in 9 are failing, if only 9 in 10 are failing, that's wonderful. It's so improbable to find something.
To add to it, I don't think it's a shortage of capital per se. There's lots of money going around, like that it gets drawn out because of the other things that we mentioned earlier, like permitting, like all these sorts of things makes your dollar just go nowhere near as far as it might otherwise go. But you have, a great track record, an awesome idea and all these sorts of things, and it all lines up. The money will be there for you, I believe. Unless you're talking about a small pocket each year where markets kind of lock up, you can get those things funded.
It's a hard job. I think it's a hard job to try and get a sufficient amount of capital if you've got an idea and no track record, but your idea is actually worthy, and especially if you're in a tricky jurisdiction that people don't tend to fund very often. I think in general, is exploration an investable asset class? The answer is no. You have to be a speculator to play there. Could it become over time an investable asset class? I think the answer is yes, but there has to be a more accessible way to for capital to understand the risks that are being taken and understand the probability of success and have some kind of parameters and bounds around that. Until then, it's tricky to see a world where real capital comes and funds the grassroots explorers, who they are the ones that make the discoveries because they've got the risk appetite to actually go to new terrain, to take on a new search space, try things, look at things with a different light. It's a tricky one. Markets have a wonderful way of solving these things over time. And if it means that commodity prices have to go higher in order to incentivize that, then that's, you know what, that's a great thing.
They do. There's another train of thought that's not so capitalistic maybe, but we had the head of the South African Council for Geoscience come and chat to us the other day, and they're sort of the holder of all the geological data, the geological library of South Africa, if you can imagine. So one train of thought is that as these individual governments, as we are becoming less and less global, as you're saying, everyone's starting to look at their own backyard and thinking, well, this is ours. How are we going to maximize value here? The other train of thought is that governments will actually assign more funding. If they want the shareholding at the end, that they will start to assign more funding for the exploration stage of projects. They're saying, look, at the end, we want a 25 or 35% stake in this business, that they then have to start contributing at this gambling phase. And I suppose the thing that will make it, the technology aspect of it that's going to make it viable, is the impact that we have now of AI and other technologies on exploration. Exploration is actually becoming a lot more accurate and a lot more, regularly successful with the advent of technology. I think one of the guys that was on the show not long ago was explaining to us that it used to be 1 in 100 drill holes came up not successful. And now if you've got all this AI-assisted algorithms and things that look at satellite imagery and I don't know what else, the success rate's claimed to be 75% now. That's ridiculous, the change.
That seems absurd. 75% success. I think oil and gas, where there is so much more unknown unknowns, are much lesser. I think it's only 33% success rate.
Might not mean you're hitting the absolute mother load, but yeah, I think
if you're twinning old holes, maybe 75% success rate.
Not to put too much of a damper on it, but a lot of the great projects and mines have also been found. So they're getting harder, they're getting deeper, all these sorts of things. So you're constantly trying to counteract that, and technology is a great way of doing so. If you just zoom out over the past 100, 200 years, you can see what commodity prices have done, and they haven't gone to the moon, and that is because of technology advancements. And that's from the discovery to the processing phase to the application phase all throughout.
Something I really like about what you guys do is how you keep the management feet to the fire. You guys are really candid in the way that you deal with, reporting cycles, and you look at the actual, let's say, board level management of these companies in the ASX, and you are the few people I find that actually keep these guys honest. And so that hard.
It helps when you're not selling to them, I would say. I mean that tongue in cheek, but genuinely, most people in the industry, they are selling something. It's be it a service or whatnot. And yeah, when someone, the person writing the check is in control of how you treat them because you're trying to earn their check. So I think that understanding that conflict was a driving force behind our choice of content in the first place. It'll be, for you guys, I'm kind of curious, which direction you'll end up taking the Mining Pulse as well, because you're starting out really broad, and I wonder if over time you'll kind of find yourself going more and more narrow as you experiment and find a niche or a way of content that speaks to you. Mm-hmm. And if I were to reframe a question to you, what style of content do you listen to? How would the Mining Pulse be if it was a podcast that you felt like you had to listen to?
Well, I'll answer part of that first, and I'll give James a moment to do it, because so you're right. I mean, right now we are very broad, but we've tried to focus sort of in three areas or four areas. So the first one is just general conversation. So whether you're knee deep in it or up to your chin in that topic, because James wants us to, and we believe in education for people, is, you know, we want it to be quite broad so that everybody comes away with a pretty better understanding. But generally, those conversations lead to a second one or a third, where it becomes a bit more in depth and things like that. So we obviously have that general series. We are doing general commodity itself, so pure individual commodity focused, which is very much today. So what's happening today on that? And we'll hopefully bring those people back to talk commodities with us and see those changes. And then probably one of my favorite ones is the founder series. So, you know, getting these guys on who have been whacking through the bush with machetes and going down rivers on a boat and exploring. And, you know, we want to go and start telling those stories because those are stories that are also never told. And as those journeys develop and progress, then, you know, telling it again, you know, evolving those stories. So I think it's not a definitive narrow like Arrowhead, you know, where it's going to be really pinpoint and sharp. I think I personally believe we'll stay fairly broad and have stuff in between that is, you know, real pinpoint, you know, like really in depth on a very specific topic. But I think it might also be too early to tell where we are today.
Yeah, and I'm sure when you look at what we're doing, it's like all over the show. It's like one thing on tailings, one thing on diamonds, one thing on this. I don't see the plan at the moment. And I'm sure our listeners won't see the plan either yet, probably because there is no clear plan. And so we'll see how it develops. I mean, I'm very much an organic growth guy. And so, yeah, I believe there's a plan, but I don't know it. Someone else or some other entity has the plan. And so it is just being divulged to me in small pieces. And so we'll see. We'll see where it ends up. But for Graham and I, we both, you know, obviously our passion is in the processing side of the mining industry. So that's where we feel comfortable and we've got a lot of experience. But as our careers have developed, it's going more and more towards the investor side of mining. And if you want to be, you know, if you want to really understand how a mining project's going to pan out or if it's going to be successful and if it's investable, you can't only look at the processing side. You've got to look broader. You've got to figure out, you've got to understand, you know, what am I going to do with the tailings? How is the legislation going to affect this? What, you know, is this the right jurisdiction to invest in? There's all sorts of aspects. And so because we are morphing as, you know, into more of the investment side of mining projects, we have to educate ourselves. And so maybe this thing is such an educational platform for us. Who knows?
Yeah, I really like that, James. You never know when you kind of start out where it's going to go. You just got to keep kind of punching forward.
And I think, you know, touching back on what James was saying as well, you know, the fact that we've been all over the show, as much as what we all have connections within the industry, and you know, you spend a lot of time now on LinkedIn trying to find these guys to come and chat. You know, with a few yeses here and a few noes there, but and I think that's also why we somewhat all over the show. But again, if we look at you guys and how successful you've been, and I'm sure you're feeling the same, well, felt the same pain as where we are today. I think as we do grow and develop, it will become maybe more streamlined and the guests that we have will hopefully be, please call us. You know, so again, I think it'll morph, as you said, you know, as we go.
I've got one request for you guys, as the very first YouTube commenter of the Mining Pulse ever.
Thank you very much.
I expect that you take my request very seriously. I think like sitting down in an air conditioned room is JD and my domain because we've never worked on a mine site. I think you guys have spent the hard yards on a mine site. And I think the kind of content I'd love to see out of you guys, and especially having been around to a bunch of sites with you, James, and seeing how, you know, you just charm the socks off of the operators. I think that would be tremendously rich content. If you can find a way to have some really rich conversations on site in your kind of your natural habitat, I think that would be really, really rich. If you so just combine the two, have the chat on site.
That's a nice challenge, actually. And it's a challenge not so much for us, but for Chris and the technical guys.
I've seen him, you know, do some sneaky recording on sites too.
You know, mine don't love when you bring cameras in. So that would be a challenge, I think. But if we can overcome that challenge, which we have sometimes, will again, then challenge accepted. And I think for, you know, for me, I really am so grateful to the two of you that whatever challenge you throw at us, we'll take seriously, because I don't know if Graham knows even, but these guys sent me a bunch of lights in a package. Took 6 months to come without you knowing that I was going to do this, right?
So you told us you had a Rodecaster that you hadn't used, but you'd bought as like a maybe idea.
You didn't, for 12 months. You didn't tell us of a plan to start a podcast, though, but you bought the Rodecaster.
I bought the Rodecaster for my wife, actually. She wanted to start a radio station. And so, this package arrives, and you didn't give me any heads up from memory. And I'm sitting there at the Port Louis post office, you know, where they, in Mauritius, they open every single package that gets delivered in front of everyone else at the post office. And so the guy there, it took 6 months to get there. And I'm thinking, what the hell did these guys send me? And they're asking me, what did they send you? And so I said, honestly, I don't know. Maybe a T-shirt. Expecting there were some T-shirts. Thank you for that as well. But out come these flipping lights, and the guy's quizzing me, saying, what is this? And I said, I don't actually know what it is. So it was funny. But thank you. I really appreciate it. And I appreciate the nudge that you guys gave us, whether it was knowingly or unknowingly. And we won't forget
that. Glad to hear it's come of use.
Yeah. Well, we've had challenges with it too.
Not actually because I'm charging my laptop in the power socket that needs to get used.
But, you know, so, I mean, challenge is accepted. Obviously, besides the Mining Pulse, which James and I have been very, very thorough to try and keep this independent, because we want anybody from industry who has a story, we want you to reach out and come and talk to us. So, yes, we are in the background doing other stuff with a very fantastic brand, and we enjoy that business because it's what really makes James and I tick. But, you know, to get onto site, we'll do it and we'll make a plan. All right. So, and we'll call you out when we're on site to say, here's the first one just for you guys. So it is accepted.
I've often thought about, because we are in such a privileged position, Graham and I, we go to the most fun places, and in a week's time, we could be on, you know, five different mines in different countries, you know, seeing different processes, different, you know, mining styles, all sorts of, you know, colors and shapes of people. So we're in such a privileged position that I've often thought, if I could just design a hard hat with a built-in GoPro, like, somewhere, you know, there's so much space between the outside and the inside of the hard hat. I'm sure someone can come up with the spy cam. And, you know, we could just record some of the stuff we see and include that so that people can see what the industry is really like. And so I think that's a good challenge.
100%.
I've actually thought about writing a book. My dad, who, besides my son, Tyler, who's probably my greatest fan, he's 10. He watches the you know, the Mining Pulse the moment it comes out, you know. But my dad has always said to me, go and write a book, because the places I've been to and the stuff I've seen, when I tell those stories, nobody believes me anyway. You know, tracking through a jungle with an AK-47 on my arm and, you know, stuff like that. But you're right. I mean, if we could tell those kind of stories and show those as well, it could be quite an interesting story, I think.
Don't know if the industry will have any investors left at the end of it, though.
Yeah, maybe that's why 9 out of 10 juniors fail.
People are drawn to it, I think.
Chris has given us the 5 minute bell.
5 minutes.
Just so you know that he's not shouting at you three, but he's shouting at me already. So,
one thing I've been dying to ask. I don't know if it's going to fit in the 5 minute window, but. In Australia, it's like you said, no country is immune to the government's chopping and changing and, you know, becoming more greedy when the prices go up and things like that. So Australia is an example. There's a few things that have changed over the years. I just left the coal industry, but I was still invested in the coal industry when they slapped that big Queensland royalty on the coal industry, which really, you know, I don't know if it helped anyone, but maybe it helped some Aussies. But
I think you were on the board of a company that it definitely did not help.
It did not help at all. So what, I mean, and then yesterday I was listening to a guy from Zim talking about some of the serious constitutional changes that Zimbabwe is trying to push through now to get their president to do another term or something, which, by the way, is not unlikely to happen in the USA. So who knows, you know. Any country has these things, but what lessons can the African governments learn from some of their lived experience in Australia around changing policy and the effect on investors?
I think capital just loves stability. These mining projects, by their very nature, they require an enormous amount of upfront capital, and the only way you're willing to expend that upfront capital is if you have some degree of certainty that for the tenor of its mine life, there's going to be a stable fiscal regime in place. You can't make an investment decision that requires $1 billion and the thing's going to be a 30-year mine life, say, and you're actually not going to get all of your $1 billion back until maybe year 9, right? So you can't make that investment decision if you think that there is even a 30 or 20% probability that the political status quo of that country is going to change. So I think be that Australia, be that Africa, I think that's the challenge for governments, is to understand that in order to attract capital, you actually have to provide genuine, stable fiscal regime. And you take Argentina as an example. They introduced this thing called a RIGI framework. Whether or not Malay gets, you know, kicked out or not, those agreements are in place. They cannot be changed. That level of certainty is kind of what you need to really attract large capital in.
Well said. I think we might use that little clip.
And maybe one final question from me, and it's maybe not so much aimed at you two, but and maybe to your viewers and our subscribers, do you guys want to see additional collaboration between Money of Mine and the Mining Pulse, even if it's 2 or 3 times a year? So if you do, leave comments. Let's hear your thoughts. And I think it's a great way to link what investors are doing in Australia into what's happening here on the ground in Africa. And hopefully we can tell that story again. So I don't know what you guys think of that, but I think hopefully the viewers like it, and it's something that you guys want to do with us as well again.
Absolutely. This has been a bunch of fun. Really appreciate you guys inviting us on the podcast as well, and would be more than happy to contribute at any time. We've just lost a camera as we sort of speak here, but I think that sounds like a great idea.
Thanks, JD, and thank you, Travis.
Thanks, JD. Thanks, Travis.
Awesome, guys.
Appreciate the time.
Thank you so much for inviting. I've got to dash, James, because I do have a beer, but wonderful to speak as always, mate.
See you guys.
To our listeners, thank you for joining us on The Mining Pulse. Don't miss a single beat of the industry's critical readout. Subscribe to The Mining Pulse now on YouTube, Spotify, or your favorite podcast platform. Please do leave your comments as they help shape these conversations that we have on The Mining Pulse. Stay tuned for the next episode as we continue tracking the heartbeat of Africa's mining industry. Stay sharp, stay informed, and stay on the pulse.